The Guardian.
Guardian Holiday Offers is pleased to bring you a great selection of worldwide trips from our trusted partners. From cultural tours and adventure holidays to river cruises and cottage breaks, we have something for everyone. To find your perfect break, go to guardian.co.uk/travel with us. That's guardian.co.uk/travel with us.
Hello, this is Science Weekly. I'm Alok Jha. On the show this week,
we do know many of the things we need to do. We are beginning to do those things, and we have the wit, the imagination to do it.
When was the last time you heard the words conservation and good news strung together? Professor Andrew Balmford is a zoologist and author of a new book aptly titled Wild Hope. I'll be talking to him about the seldom told conservation success stories. And
the next big milestone, the next massive stepping stone on this voyage of discovery is going to be a twin of the Earth. And we, as I said before, we think we're on the brink of this, and it's probably going to be Kepler that will discover this Earth-like planet.
Ahead of his Royal Institution course, giving punters a guide on how to search for aliens, Lewis Dartnell is here to discuss a new era in the search for life beyond our blue planet. This is Science Weekly from The Guardian. Andrew Balmford is a zoologist and a professor of conservation science at the University of Cambridge. Like everyone else, he's concerned about the increasing degradation of the natural world. But instead of beating people over the head with warnings, Andrew's taken a more positive approach. In his new book, Wild Hope, he tells stories about people and places where nature has made a successful comeback. Andrew came into the Science Weekly studio to talk to me about his book. So, Andrew, thank you for coming into the podcast. Can you start by telling us a little bit about why you've taken this particular angle on this book? I mean, conservation is something that we hear about only in negative terms. Things are dying out. We have to do something about it. You've decided to write about conservation from a completely different angle. It's all about the good news. So why that way?
So it's undoubtedly the case that nature really is in serious trouble. Species are in decline. The resources we depend on are in declining rapidly, and those losses affect us all. They affect us materially, they affect us spiritually, and it's a moral issue. And I'm convinced, like many scientists working in my area, that we have precious little time to do something about this. Maybe one generation or so of our own species left to turn things around before the damage becomes irreparable. But nevertheless, if you look around, there are some places where things are getting better, not worse. And that led me to conceive that what we really need, if we're going to move things forward, is not just to push those negative messages. Those are very important to attract people's attention, but you have to give them some reason to believe there's a solution to those problems.
That conservation plans work.
That conservation action can work, that their individual behaviour can change what's happening on the ground. And I think that's fundamentally important for two reasons, to motivate people to care. And this, we're not going to solve the problem, or indeed any problem, without people believing that things can change for the better. Nothing was ever solved that way. Second, because while, as I say, some conservation activities are working, many are not working for a whole load of different reasons. And if we can study the case studies where things are working, we can improve our own success rate and therefore make more progress more quickly.
Now, in our bid to be relentlessly positive about conservation for the next few minutes, let's go through some examples which you cover in your book. So tell me about the Loma Alto region in Ecuador. What was the problem? How was it solved?
So this is an extraordinary place. It's an isolated ridge of mountains in western Ecuador, so way over to the Pacific coast, west of the Andes, which are exceptionally diverse biologically. The forests there hold extraordinary richness of creatures that are found nowhere else. But for the last half century or more, the area has been heavily deforested by people for a variety of different uses, and there's precious few fragments of this very, very rich, biologically rich forest left. Biologists have realized this for quite a while, and for the past 10 or 20 years, they've been exhorting local people in charge of the last few fragments of their forest to do something about it, to save the forest for the good of humanity as a whole and because of these biological treasures. But despite all that exhortation, things weren't really changing. Then a very smart American biologist went there initially to study the birds and sat looking at the forest and thinking, well, why should the local people care about conserving this forest? What's in it for them? Not for the birds, but what's in it for the local people? And what she came to realize from looking at the forest and looking at its relation to the village down below was that the forest during the dry season extraordinarily traps fog that rolls in off the Pacific Ocean during the dry season. It intercepts the fog, and the fog then drips down through the forest and comes on down through the streams to the villages below and waters the people's fields and enables them to keep farming, even during the dry season. And then working with local people and with volunteers, she was able to measure the size of this effect, the effect of having the forest there in terms of fog interception and ultimately water runoff, compared with the effect of having cut down the forest or used it to grow pasture for cows, and was able to, through some very simple science, be able to demonstrate to the local people the cost to their local economy of the forest they'd already cut down and what they stood to lose into the future. And within 3 months of starting to collect those data with local people, she was able to present the data to the assembly of the local community, and they, off their own bat, declared a reserve over the whole of what was left of the forest. So what had previously taken more than 10 years of conventional conservation and still hadn't succeeded in 3 months did by seeing the forest, not from the point of view of the birds, but the point of view of the local people.
So what were the local people doing before then, though? Why was there resistance to maintaining the forest?
So they were, on the one hand, some people were using parts of the forest, they were clearing it to grow extraordinarily what's called Panama hat plant, which is the plant which is used, the fibres are then used to weave to make Panama hats. Panama hats don't come from Panama, they come from Ecuador. They're called Panama hats because they happened to first be popularised on the Panama Canal when it was being built. But they come from Ecuador, and they can only be made from this particular plant. So there was a living to be made through clearing the forest to grow this particular
purely
plant.
Economic arguments there. Let's go for one more example. There's an intriguing example about the land being turned over in the Netherlands to nature. Something very... you wouldn't expect this from a Western developed country.
No, exactly. And to my mind, this sort of epitomises where the bar might be, or how high the bar might be in terms of our aspirations for conservation. The Netherlands is, in terms of economic activity for its size, about the most profitable country on Earth, bar a few island states and city states. So incredibly profitable and busy place. And yet, despite that, starting in the 1990s, the government in the Netherlands decided to try to restore nature across the country on a truly remarkable scale. So in the UK, we have a few, 2, 3, 4% of land is under natural habitats, if you like. In the Netherlands, their aim is to go back by 2018 to having a sixth of the country under nature. So under woodland or wetland or rivers, marsh areas and so on. And to connect all those patches, both the ones that existed before and the new ones they're creating from scratch, to connect them all via a corridor of a series of corridors so that species can move between those areas and populations can remain viable over the long term. And it's resulted in some truly extraordinary things. So in the Netherlands, which we think of as being a very engineered landscape, they're literally towards the end of the Rhine River, they're taking down the dikes that have held the river in place for so long and allowing the river to flood over a much wider area. And that's because they've worked out that there's so much siltation gone on in the river that if they keep the dikes there and keep it in a very narrow channel, it runs a real risk of flooding and damaging a great deal of property. Instead, if they can expand the floodplain and reinstate the delta that was there at the end of the river, they've got much more area to absorb the impact of floods. And at the price of actually removing quite a lot of infrastructure, even one or two villages, they can nevertheless reduce the long-term risk of flooding, which is terribly important. Elsewhere, to those corridors, they've even gone to the extent of building special bridges for nature over motorways and railways. So if you go on, you can go on to something like Google Earth and follow some of the big roads in the Netherlands, and you'll see these enormous bridges that appear across the roads. And these are green bridges on one side of the river. On one side of the road, there'll be a woodland. There'll be another woodland on the other side. There'll be this vast bridge in between the two, so that animals can move from one to the other, and these populations can remain connected. So they're doing things on an extraordinary scale, and it's, again, for a mix of reasons. It's things like flood protection, it's things like carbon storage, because nature, land under nature, tends to soak up rather than emit carbon dioxide. And crucially, again, because people, politicians in particular, recognise that these landscapes offer enormous potential for combating obesity, combating stress. And so despite the fact that this initiative costs a fortune of the order of $500 million a year, it survived successive changes of government in the Netherlands.
Now, I've said we're going to be positive in this interview, but I think that it is still worth highlighting the massive scale of extinction and the problems with animals and plants around the world because of human impacts and climate change and other things. And I just want to finish by asking you to set the scene a little bit, which why does all the stuff you're talking about matter? What is the scale of the problem we're trying to deal with using techniques like the ones you're describing and attitudes like the one you're describing?
So we know that roughly since we got going, we've removed, destroyed, cut down, whatever, about a half of what nature there was, let's say at the start of the Industrial Revolution. So about half of it's gone. We're losing somewhere around 1% of it left, that's left each year. So things are disappearing fast. And in geological terms, in terms of the history of life on Earth, it's taking place in the blinking of an eye. So we're losing species at a rate which is 1,000 times the average rate that we can detect from average turnover in the fossil record. And it turns out that the Earth probably hasn't seen that sort of biological change of that speed since at least the last mass extinction event, which was 65 million years ago. We know that recovery from those events, from looking at the fossil record, we know that takes tens of millions of years. So to all intents and purposes, once it's happened, as far as people are concerned, it's over. We also know that just in material terms, the benefits that we get from nature, not just the material things, not just the tangible things that go through markets like fish, wild-caught fish or timber or whatever that we can easily attach a value to, but the things we can't attach a value to so easily, like the role of natural places in climate regulation, in floodwater regulation, in terms of providing us with clean drinking water and so on, that the value of those services is absolutely immense. Exactly how large is extremely difficult to gauge, but we know from putting those two pieces of information together that, very roughly speaking, 1 year's loss of nature costs human well-being of the order of $1 to $5 trillion a year. Not a few billion or a few thousand or a few hundred billion, but $1 to $3 trillion. That's thousands of billions of dollars worth of loss to our economy every year. So the stakes are extremely high, and we know from studying systems that have changed over the last 50 to 100 years that we reach a point in many systems where things tip, things change into a fundamentally different state. We had an extremely profitable fishery off the Grand Banks for centuries, and then decades of particularly heavy overfishing caused that to collapse, have switched the system to a state where now there are no cod to be caught there at all. So flips happen, and we don't know where those tipping points are, but we expect that there will be many of those in different systems around the world. And we can say that we're getting dangerously close to many of them. What this researching for this book has taught me is that On the one hand, while that means we absolutely must do something about it, it isn't a thing we've got a choice about. We absolutely have to if we're serious about the quality of our life and that of our children into the future. Not only must we do something about it, but the good news is that we can. We do know many of the things we need to do. We are beginning to do those things, and we have the wit, the imagination to do it. And increasingly, in places like Assam or the Netherlands, we see that people have the will to do it as well.
And some of you thought that the Netherlands was only good for coffee shops. Andrew Barnford's Wild Hope is published by the University of Chicago Press. All royalties will be going to conservation organisations whose work the book celebrates. Staying with conservation, all this week on the Guardian website, we'll be running a series of articles on the global crisis in biodiversity. There'll be articles by John Vidal on the loss of sounds in the natural world. John Watts will be writing on Ecuador's attempt to be the most biodiverse country in the world. And I'm presenting a special short film on botanical conservation carried out at Kew Gardens here in London, headed up by its chief scientist, Professor Stephen Hopper.
Plants on the planet are at the crossroads. About half the aerial extent of the planet occupied by wild plant diversity is now sequestered by humans for other purposes. And in terms of the species of plants on the planet, we estimate there's 400,000. About a fifth of them are threatened in some way.
And so this is due to humans basically clearing forests, moving things out of the ways to build cities. It's down to us.
In the main it is, absolutely. We require space for growing crops, for cities, for industrial infrastructure. All of those have contributed to this removal of wild vegetation. Therefore the responsibility to do something about it is also down.
So what do we do? What can we do to stem this global tide of plants dying?
I think we're at a time when a new deal for the environment is really called for. And we're actually in that transition. There are people doing some wonderful things in various places. So the sort of things we have to do is take a view that we are going to reduce and stop fairly soon destroying further wild vegetation unless absolutely essential. And that is about people stopping fairly urgently continuing destruction of wild vegetation, getting into the positive activity of restoring and repairing where it makes a lot of sense and it's useful to us, where it will guarantee that we have a higher probability of a sustainable existence well into the future. So people can do all sorts of things. Plants have seeds. Seeds can be collected and stored. They can be germinated. We can put plants back into places where they're of value to us, or where we simply want to ensure that biodiversity will persist with our help.
That was a short extract from my interview with the chief scientist at Kew Gardens, Stephen Hopper. To see that film in full and read our week's worth of articles, go to guardian.co.uk/environment. Looking for life on other worlds is one of those things that's kept humans intrigued for centuries. But it's only in recent decades that the scientific communities really got into it wholesale. Astrobiology is the scientific discipline that's coalesced to answer the questions of where, how, and what form life might take out there in space. It's definitely been on everyone's minds recently due to the landing of the Curiosity probe on Mars. So when I met up with astrobiologist Lewis Dartnell, I started by asking him a seemingly straightforward question. How would we recognise alien life if we ever found it?
There is kind of a fundamental chicken-the-egg problem, you're right, in the search for life on other planets. Life that, by definition, would be alien. It would be different from us. So, in a way, you might not know what it is you're looking for until you found it. So how do you know what kind of experiment or test design to look for something that might, by definition, be different from us?
Quite. What do you look for, yeah?
Well, you look for kind of universal stuff. So there's a vast diversity of life on Earth, but fundamentally we're all based on the same kind of chemistry, same kind of stuff. So we're water-based and we're built out of organic molecules, carbon chemistry. So even if alien life doesn't use DNA or it doesn't use proteins, it uses different molecular machinery to us. Even if it's built in a different way, it will certainly use, at least we think, certainly use carbon compounds, carbon molecules to do this. So the Curiosity rover, for example, has got an organic sniffer. It's got instruments that will be able to detect even very trace amounts of carbon chemistry, the building blocks of life.
This is on Mars, of course.
Yeah.
Although Curiosity, as we've discussed before, isn't specifically looking for life, is it? It's one of those things where it's going to find signs and then maybe future missions.
Yeah, so you need to be careful. curiosity will not be able to find unambiguous evidence of life, but it's all about talking about the habitability of Mars, how appropriate it was for life, how warm and wet it's once been.
So your course at the Royal Institution, you're going to start with this question of what life is, and it's a question that people have tried to attack from many different ways. I mean, the famous Schrödinger lectures in the 50s, for example, or the 40s rather, that really started off the idea that that there must be a replicating molecule, which then eventually became DNA and stuff. I mean, how do you begin to tackle this subject for someone who isn't steeped in it all the time?
Well, there's a phenomenal video that I always show in the beginning of all talks I do for astrobiology, which is basically a day in the life of one of our cells. It's a Harvard University video called BioVision, so people could Google for that online now if they wanted. And it zooms into one of our cells and basically shows us how we work, the kind of molecular machinery behind life. And we see the three different components of life that you need to put together to build a cell. So the DNA, the information that you mentioned, it's a digital store of information, the same way that a DVD is a digital store, but it's stored chemically. And you need to have metabolism, you need to have a kind of biochemistry to make all the building blocks of cells for you and to extract energy and the environment to power your life. And thirdly, but just importantly, you basically need a bag or a sack to stuff everything into so these giblets don't drift away. And that's the cell membrane. And actually, it turns out that cell membranes are some of the most kind of resilient and robust parts of a cell. And it's that kind of chemistry you find sticking around billions of years later in the rocks that we find in the oldest rocks on Earth.
And so, in a sense, you can talk about the biology of these things. But once again, I go back to my question, why necessarily does that mean that you'll find that on, Gliese 581b or something, many, many light years away? By the way, that's not saying that we have found life there, but I'm just...
Well, stop the press.
What makes you confident that these rules will apply there?
So, I mean, you are right. As we've already talked about, you don't know quite what it is you might be looking for until you found it. But when you're talking about broad brushstrokes and universalities and kind of generalities about life on Earth, we can be quite confident we think you can start extending them to other places. And in order to be a life form, whether you're carbon-based or silicon-based, whether you drink liquid water or drink methane, you've got to have some fundamental functions. Otherwise, you're not alive. You need to have an information store and then copy and transmit that to the next generation. Because without information, then the cell's got nothing to...
What was that classic biology phrase about, biology mnemonic about what life is?
Mrs. Gren or something, isn't it?
Yeah, does that even stand for? I can't remember now. Metabolism,
respiration. So in a way, it's a list of things that most life does, but it's not a definition. This is, as we've already hinted, this is the kind of slippery process of trying to pin down what life actually is. And we can think of things that all life on Earth has or does, but in a way, it's just a descriptive list rather than a definition.
That's right.
It's really hard to pin down. And this is one of the reasons why finding life on Mars would be so important and so exciting, because we then have another example to, compare against. You can do, like you do kind of cross comparisons in geography or politics or something. You look at different systems. Looking at two fundamentally different biological systems would tell us a lot about Martian life. But I think it also tells us an awful lot about ourselves as well, how we work.
So, you can kind of extrapolate from life here what cells might be like in other places.
Yeah.
But what kinds of environments would be amenable to life elsewhere? We breathe oxygen, we need water. I'm assuming that other life forms could do different things.
Yeah, so if we stick with life will need liquid water, although there are alternatives and people talking about one of Saturn's moons called Titan, which has got lakes of this kind of weird hydrocarbon mix of ethane and methane. If you could stand on the surface and not die instantly, it'd probably smell a lot like a kind of fuel station, like a petrol station with these hydrocarbons evaporating off its lakes. So there's plenty of wet stuff on Titan. So maybe with some kind of exotic biochemistry that's methane-based rather than water-based, that there could be Titanic life that's very, very alien, very, very different from us. But actually what I find one of these kind of mind-blowing concepts of astrobiology is that all life on Earth is basically the same. We've all evolved from the same mother, the same progenitor. But if you had life on Titan, you could have methane-based life on the surface. And deeper down underground on Titan, we think there's a kind of mushy sea of liquid water with kind of ammonia antifreeze in it. So it's almost like you'd have life in the kind of magma ocean beneath the surface of the Earth. You'd have water-based life in the watery magma beneath the surface of Titan. So Titan might be a world with two completely separate biospheres. You'd have methane-based life on the surface, water-based life deep underground. And, you know, never the twain could meet because they're based on fundamentally different chemistry.
And this was fundamentally the story behind that, in the end, wrong arsenic life idea a few years ago, when some researchers apparently found that there was a bacterium that used arsenic instead of phosphorus in its DNA, which would have meant that it would have had a different progenitor. You said we all come from the same mother, a different mother, and two sort of starts of life. It must have been a really exciting time for a little while.
Everyone was excited. And, you know, with 2020 hindsight, it's turned out that the original paper left a lot to be desired in terms of scientific methodology and rigorousness. But that's how science proceeds. You make bold statements and people criticise and test and try to repeat your results and either stand.
But the idea is, talks to a bit of your idea earlier that there could be different chemical forms of life doing different things. So,
but again, this is a central problem of astrobiology. We know how to look for life like us because that's what we do in laboratories. So there could be not exactly alien life. It would be terrestrial, be earthly life, just based in very different chemistry, maybe from a different origin, that we're just overlooking every day because we don't know how to recognise it. Maybe we see it in our ponds, but probably actually more likely it's in a very extreme environment, maybe deep in the crust or deep beneath the ocean's waves.
So at the moment, the NASA's Kepler probe is out there surveying star systems all over the galaxy, looking for finding new exoplanets almost every day. It's an incredible rate at which it's doing that. And given that, 10 years ago, we hardly knew about any exoplanets, it's quite an incredible thing. A lot of them are mostly size of Jupiter and big gas balls. Occasionally, there's a rocky one there, and we'll get technology that's even better to look at the atmospheres of those things, and it's going to get even better and better. What is the likelihood that we're going to find life in the next 50 years?
I mean, evidence of it. I mean, that's the million-dollar question. And you're absolutely right about these exoplanets turning up on a daily basis. There's an app you can download for your smartphone called, it's all about exoplanets, and it would send you a notification every time a new planet's discovered. And I turned that off basically like a year ago, so you just get bored with these new notifications of a new planet every single day. It's exciting, but it's now become commonplace.
It's so routine. It's weird that it's become routine.
Exactly, but it became routine within a matter of kind of 5-6 years. It's ludicrous how quickly you become
readjusted. We used to report every single new planet that was discovered. Now you just think, goodness.
But the next big milestone, the next massive stepping stone on this voyage of discovery is going to be a twin of the Earth. And as I said before, we think we're on the brink of this, and it's probably going to be Kepler that will discover this Earth-like planet. So you can wait for a clear night, and you can step out, your mum and dad and your brothers and sisters and your mates, and point up to the constellation Cygnus in the night sky, because this is where Kepler is looking. And you can point that place in the night sky and say that is where we're likely to first find a twin of our world. That's where our robotic space telescopes are most likely to find an Earth-like planet orbiting another star, a sun-like star.
Okay, so if we do find one, when do you reckon it's going to happen?
So, feasibly the next couple of years.
Give me a prediction.
So, okay, I'm going to make two bets with you, Alok. 20 quid each. With the next 3 years, we'll have found an Earth-like planet in a habitable orbit of a sun-like star. So an orbit of around a year around a sun-like star. And before I die, otherwise I won't be able to collect my bet, we'll have found evidence of life beyond our Earth. And actually, my bet is that we'll find that evidence for extraterrestrial life far away from us, on a planet orbiting a distant star,
so you're confident
rather than someone like Mars.
It does exist.
Yes. I mean, in a way, I'm kind of betting my career on it, right? So I think there's a good enough chance that there is something out there waiting to be discovered that I'm willing to put my career towards. I think that's the thing that gets me out of bed in the morning. That's what I think is exciting.
So let's go back to your course for the RI then. What kind of people are you hoping you're going to turn up to learn about these things? I mean, there is this element that searching for alien life, in whatever its form, is a very exciting, evocative thing to do. And are they going to be disappointed coming along and listening to geology and biology? Or do you think there's another way of exciting them about the same subject?
I hope I can still inspire people. And there's...
Basically, I'm like, are you going to bore them?
There's a lot that's being discovered the whole time. So we'll look at some of the cutting edge results and discoveries, and we'll talk about what Curiosity is hoping to do and what it's done so far. And I think, basically the course is for anyone. It's, for school children, adults, people coming after work, OAPs. It's one of those fields that is... I think everyone has talked about with their family or their friends, down in the pub or walking through the park or something, or you're going on a camping trip and you see this glorious spread of stars above your head. I think everyone's had that conversation with people around them. You know, what if we're alone? What if we're not? What if something's out there? Where might it be? How might we find it? And that's those kind of fundamental questions that I want to discuss and chat about. Because it won't just be blah, 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 me kind of lecturing at the front. I want to make it very, you know, discursive and to and fro and conversational.
Talking of big space events of late, the Curiosity rover we've mentioned already, it's on Mars now. It's just going to start doing some science very soon. It's an amazing thing, and probably the most followed space rover on Twitter.
Exactly, has its own Twitter account, as does the rocket blaster with its laser shooter. A couple
well,
days.
Anyway, it's an amazing thing. Give us a bit of an update. You must be excited about the whole thing anyway. But what's got your interest lately, and what should we look out for in the next few months?
Yeah, this is real edge of the seat stuff. This is the most capable robot, the largest robot we've ever sent to Mars.
And it has a laser.
Nuclear powered. It's got a laser. It's got 17 different cameras. It's already sending back. You know, jaw-dropping. If you haven't done so already, Google for some of the Curiosity images already sent back, and it's just these alien but also really familiar landscapes of the Martian landscape. I mean, it could be any kind of desert on Earth with this mountain receding into the distance. And we're about to start doing some science. So it landed a couple of weeks ago. They've been basically doing kind of engineering tests, making sure that its wheels work, making sure that its cameras work, making sure that its different instruments and equipment works. And it's now trundling towards... it's a kind of a junction. It's about 400 meters away. I think it's a junction between different geological areas. So it wants to start testing its instruments on this interesting region and see what it can find about the different rock types there and how much water might have been around on the ancient Martian surface when they lay down. But the real goal of the Curiosity mission, the Mars Science Laboratory mission, is this mountain peaking in the center of Gale Crater called Sharp Mountain. And the reason we want to go there is it's basically going to allow Curiosity to be like a time machine. We'll start in the very, very ancient, primordial time of Mars, where it was very warm and wet, where we see kind of clay-like minerals laid down in standing water and lakes and seas. And then as Curiosity will drive up this mountain, we'll steadily go forward, we'll come forward and forward in time, watching this kind of catastrophic collapse of the Martian environment. As atmosphere is blown away into space and the water dries up and it becomes the barren, probably dead place we see today. And it was that story that we're going to be uncovering over the next year or so with Curiosity.
What are the other missions that are going to be launched? What things excite you about the next few decades of space? NASA's already announced it's going to have another...
So there's InSight, which NASA
A lander on Mars.
Yeah, which will be mostly a geological mission. We'll be looking at Mars quakes.
And then there's ExoMars from the European Space Agency.
And that's one that I'm directly working on myself. So I'm not directly involved in Curiosity, but obviously the results it sends back are going to be really important for the whole discipline of astrobiology. But the thing I am directly working on is ExoMars, and this... Unlike Curiosity, ExoMars will be a specifically kind of alien hunting mission. It'll have the equipment to find signs of microbial life, hopefully, if it's there. And one of the instruments I'm directly working on, and when I move to Leicester for my next fellowship from UCL, is the Raman instrument. It's another laser-based instrument. We're all about lasers nowadays. And it's a laser-based instrument that can pick up the kind of pigments and then the molecules of microbial life. So things like chlorophyll that life on Earth uses to soak up the sun's energy to grow by.
And where next in the solar system? Because there are lots of places around the sort of gas giants that look exciting.
The icy moons, yeah. So
where would you go if you had a couple of billion?
I'd be torn, to be honest, between Titan, which, as we mentioned, is a hydrocarbon soaked planet. Sorry, moon. So it would have exotic biochemistry life on it. But actually, I'd probably prefer to go to Europa, which we think beneath its frozen, icy surface, there lies a dark, deep, alien ocean of liquid water. And in fact, we think Europa's got more liquid water than even the Earth.
So Europa is one of the moons of Jupiter.
It's one of the moons of Jupiter, yeah. So it's Europa that's the water world of our solar system, not the Earth. And in many ways, Europa's got a better chance of harbouring life today even than Mars does. So we'd really like to go there. It's just difficult to get to. It's a long, long way away. It orbits deeper than the gravity well of Jupiter. You can't use parachutes to land on Europa because it has no atmosphere. It orbits deep in a very intense radiation belt, basically the Van Allen belt of Jupiter. So it's incredibly difficult and hazardous as a kind of space environment to go to. And then once we do land on the surface, you're going to want to drill through perhaps several kilometres solid ice to get down to this ocean. So it's enticing and it's exciting and it's until now completely unexplored. But it's a nasty one to get to.
There must be proposals for missions.
There's one called JUICE, which is an unfortunate acronym. It's the Jupiter and Icy Moons Explorer. And this is another European Space Agency. There's another ESA mission. And it won't be landing on Europa, and it won't be falling into orbit around Europa, but it'll be orbiting around Jupiter and have lots of flybys of this icy moon and the other icy moons of Jupiter. Because one of the things we want to find out about Europa before we start planning where to land and drilling down through its ice is we want to find regions where we think that the ocean may have recently kind of bubbled and melted its way through to the surface. I find that the most fresh, recent locations on Europa where the oceans come into contact, because that's where the ice will be thinnest and easier to drill through. We might have, you know, the kind of chemistry of that ocean preserved in the ice that we could sense without having to drill too far. So JUICE is a proposed mission, but it won't be launched until the 2020s. So all these missions, particularly ones to the outer planets, that you know, you're looking a long way into the future because they're so expensive and take so long to fly out there.
Lewis, thank you very much. Well, hopefully you can come back in 30 years and talk about that.
I'll come back in a little while and see what curiosity.
Yeah, let's see. Thanks a lot, Lewis.
Cheers.
Thanks there to Lewis Dartnell. If his words have piqued your interest in all things astrobiological, do go along to his lecture series, which starts on Tuesday, the 11th of September in London. Go to the Royal Institution website to find out more, rigb.org. That's all we have for this edition of Science Weekly. You can keep up to speed with breaking science news at any time, of course, on guardian.co.uk/science. But from me, Alok Jha, and Science Weekly producer Jason Phipps, it's goodbye.
Guardian Holiday Offers is pleased to bring you a great selection of worldwide trips from our trusted partners. From cultural tours and adventure holidays to river cruises and cottage breaks, we have something for everyone. To find your perfect break, go to guardian.co.uk/travel with us. That's guardian.co.uk/travel with us.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.